All right, welcome. We are now tonight to this week's Parshas, Parshas Korach. The title is Rabbinic Scandal and the Hashtag Me Too Movement. Where am I going with this, you might say? All right, let's go to a video. It's going to be a little disturbing, but, you know, you guys are adults. Let's go to the video first.
Elsewhere, prominent Israeli rabbi has been indicted on 13 counts of grave sexual crimes against women who turned to him with religious questions. Rabbi Ezra Scheinberg is 46 years old and married with 8 children. He was considered both a Torah scholar and a Kabbalist with special powers. As a result, he was often consulted by members of his own community and some from outside it. According to the indictment, he abused his children, sexually exploited women who consulted him. The rabbi has also been charged with indecent assault, fraud, and interfering with a criminal investigation against him. He was arrested at the airport earlier this month as he reportedly waited to catch a flight to Brazil.
Okay. All right, so that's not a pleasant thing, but all right, let's get some of the wrong class. Wrong class, here we go. Sure. You guys see the sheet?
Yes.
Yes.
I took a little snippet from the newspaper. This just came out recently. All right, so Mendel, read it out.
Rabbi Antfas sentenced to 7.5 years in jail for sexual assault. Ezra Scheinberg, ex-yeshiva head, confessed to using his position as spiritual leader to take advantage of 8 women. The Oros Ha'ari students are still shocked by the arrest and suspicions against their former yeshiva head and are finding it difficult to accept that the, quote, great Kabbalist, unquote, who many of them had asked for advice and for blessings, is now being portrayed as a sex offender. Scheinberg was considered the protege of former chief rabbi Mordechai Eliyahu, who was one of the leaders of religious Zionism. Scheinberg's power increased after Eliyahu's death in 2010, and many of the late rabbi's followers began following him. Part of his MO involved convincing the victims that only he could provide a solution to their problems through a treatment he dubbed relaxation. During those sessions, Scheinberg fraudulently obtained his victim's consent to commit sexual acts, prosecutors said, adding that the defendant used innocent young women who trusted him as a tool to satisfy his sexual desires.
All right. All pretty horrible.
That beat straight out of TMZ, for crying out loud.
Right. I took some of the article from when it was the indictment, and then it came out that he was convicted and he's going to go to jail for 7.5 years. Okay. All right. Question number one. Suzanne, read it out.
How is it possible that such a renowned and knowledgeable rabbi could have used his position to sleep with these women?
Okay. How do you make sense of something like this?
People trusted him.
Okay.
Because, you know, he was a great, you know, leader in the community.
No, I understand how he did his crime. But the question is, I think, you know, if a person is a knowledgeable and well-renowned rabbi, you would think that would make that person sort of like immune from doing such a hideous activity.
Well, go to Hollywood. This is the norm. What do you mean?
I understand that, but I go back. This is not a person who, in other words, I don't have a, look, in the Me Too movement, obviously, let's say, for example, like right now, Harvey Weinstein is indicted on many counts of sexual assault and rape, etc. But that's disgraceful behavior. But he never put himself up as being a moral leader. You know what I'm saying?
It seems like what this guy was learning and we've mentioned that you have mentioned this in the past. I mean, it seems like what this guy was learning was not actually impactful on this person's internal psyche.
That's an understatement. Okay. But it's like, but wouldn't you imagine even like a regular person wouldn't do this?
Right. There is something twisted about this person.
We're not really capturing what the mechanism here is. All right, so, and I'll go into question number two. Why did the scandal take so much time to surface and be prosecuted? It was many years.
I think that's what Scott was saying earlier. I mean, he took advantage of his power, and everybody trusted him, and he basically took advantage of that.
And they were afraid to come out because he was, it's like the, you know, Harvey Weinstein kind of thing. It's like he's a powerful person. Like a lot of people, you know, he can, you know, a lot of people, I don't know how to say it.
Well, and it makes you wonder if anybody did report it, if people said, no, this couldn't be, you read this wrong, you...
Right.
Correct. In other words...
You misinterpreted the events. He didn't actually rape you, he did something else.
Right.
Right, so that's a very important point. In other words, there's a thing called cognitive dissonance, where reality takes you what tells you one thing, but your vision, or going back to last week's class, your map of the world, the way that you want to see the world, is the opposite, and you don't integrate those two things. So if you have a beloved rabbi, you can't imagine it's just simply intolerable to consider that when it was actually announced. In other words, initially, there was a gag order during the investigation, so they didn't know who it was. When that gag order was lifted by the judge, literally the people in the community were like, they tore Kriya. They like ripped their clothes like a, and they were like, it was just devastating. Their whole world was just crushed. Crushed. Just simply could not process it. Couldn't process it. So the question we haven't really answered is what's the mechanism to have such a situation that somebody of such powerful, you know, knowledge, you know, such an, and not just a rabbi, because in Israel there are a lot of rabbis, but a rabbi is viewed as a leading rabbi, somehow can go from a great height to an amazingly great depth. You know what I'm saying? To a behavior that the average person would never imagine doing. So we haven't really understand the mechanism here. All right, but this week's parsha will teach us this important, or the parsha of Korach, which talks about failings of many people. The Torah spends time about failings. Last week's parsha we had the Meraglim. The week before that in Baloska we talked about the people who were the complainers. You had different circumstances which the Torah tells of the foibles, the mistakes of both great people and average people for one reason. What's that reason?
Because it's educational?
Yeah, so we can learn from that. In other words, the goal here is not to become, the idea of being a religious person is not synonymous with being a naive person. The Torah is explicit, and we're going to learn some stuff which will be a little shocking. We're going to use some of the commentary on the story from the Talmud itself, which is a little bit shocking. This is a little bit of a PG version of the Chumash here. But, you know, you're adults, and, you know, you got to learn stuff. Okay. Let's read this. Let's just refresh our recollection on the basic story. All right, so... read the actual text of the Chumash.
Korach's rebellion, Bamidbar, chapter 16, pasuk 1. Korach, son of Yitzhar, a grandson of Kehath and great grandson of Levi, began a rebellion along with Dathan and Aviram, sons of Eliav, and On, son of Peleth, descendants of Reuven. They had a confrontation with Moshe along with 250 people of the nation who were men of rank in the community, representatives at the assembly, and famous. They demonstrated against Moshe and Aaron and declared to them, "You have gone too far. All the people in the community are holy and God is with them. Why are you setting yourselves above God's congregation?" When Moshe heard this, he threw himself on his face. Then he spoke to Korach and his whole party. "Tomorrow morning," he said, "God will show that he knows who is his and who is holy, and he will bring them close to him. He shall choose those who shall be allowed to present offerings to him. This is what you must do. Let Korach and his entire party take fire pans. Tomorrow place fire on them and offer incense on them before God. The man whom God chooses shall then be the holy one. You sons of Levi have also gone too far." Moshe tried to I'm assuming Korach says that to the sons of Levi. Moshe tried to reason.
No. Moshe telling Korach and his people, "You sons of Levi have also gone too far."
Okay. So all of Korach's cohort were Levian?
So that would be it's not clear. It just says 250 men of renown.
Right.
So it's not clear where are they from. Rosh is going to answer that question.
Okay. I thought Korach was leveling another accusation against the Levium themselves. But, okay. So this is Moshe saying to Korach's cohort, "You sons of Levi have also gone too far." Okay. Chapter 16, verse 8. Moshe tried to reason with Korach. "Listen to what I have to say, you sons of Levi. Isn't it enough that the God of Israel separated you from the community of Yisrael? He has brought you close to him, allowing you to serve in God's tabernacle and to minister as the community's leaders. Although he gave this privilege to you and all your fellow Levites, you are now also demanding the priesthood. It is actually against God that you and your party are demonstrating. After all, who is Aaron that you should have grievances against him?" Moshe then sent word to summon Dathan and Aviram, the sons of Eliab. "We won't come," was their response. "Isn't it enough that you brought us out of Egypt, a land flowing with milk and honey, just to kill us in the desert? What right do you have to set yourselves above us? You didn't bring us to a land flowing with milk and honey or give us inheritance of fields and vineyards. Do you think that you can pull something over our eyes? We will definitely not come."
All right, so there are two groups of people that have grievances. What's Korach's grievance? At least that were from the way that Moshe is understanding it.
It sounds like Korach and his specific group want to bring sacrifices.
So they want to be what?
Priests. They want to be Kohanim or priests.
Right, and well, particularly when he mentioned they want to be, instead of Aaron, they want to be the high priest. And basically implied in that claim is, why did Moshe pick his brother?
Because he was the high priest.
No, why did Moshe pick his brother Aaron as the high priest?
Because God told him to.
What's their contention?
That Moshe did it. That it was nepotism.
There you go. Really? He says, everybody, we're all holy. Kulana Kudosha, we're all holy, and God's amongst all of us. Why are you taking so much? All right, it's a power grab. You're taking all the good positions. And what about Dathan and Aviram from the tribe of Reuben? Do they have the same criticism?
It looks like they are also in with Korach, no?
They are part of Korach's coalition. Do they have the same issue?
No. No, they felt like they were brought into the desert to die by Moshe, and they left Egypt, which was a land flowing with milk and honey.
So what's their problem?
They want to go, they want to say in the agenda and the itinerary of the travels of the nation.
Right, they basically say that Moshe is a failed leader. So Korach and the 250 guys, seem to be indicting Aaron as being was given the job as high priest as an act of nepotism. And Dathan and Aviram, their contention is they're angry because they feel that Moshe failed them, because remember, this is right after the spies, so they're now condemned to live in the desert to die, and they were promised a nice package to be living in the land of Israel, and then we got nothing. We're getting screwed here. Okay? So this is a complete meltdown of the situation. All right? Now, let's take a little bit of the Talmud here. This is from Sanhedrin 110a. Let's have Suzanne read the words of the Talmud. Go ahead.
It is written, and they arose before Moshe with men from the children of Israel, 250 princes of the congregation, the elect men of the assembly, men of renown. These men were the distinctive people of the assembly. The elect men of the assembly is referring to those who knew how to intercalate the years and establish the months in order to determine the time for each festival. Men of renown is referring to those who had a reputation throughout the world.
All right, so the Gemara here quotes a, when you have midrashic material that's in the Talmud, it has its own name. It's called Agadah, right? Similar to Haggadah, to tell over, but Agadah means non-halachic commentary about, in this case, the Torah itself. And the way is that Kriyei Moed means literally call to the tent of assembly. In other words, these are the machers that are called for all the leadership meetings, these 250 guys, right? The Medrash is telling us a play on words. Kriyei can also be, they're called Moed. They declare the Moed, which means that these people, what level of knowledge they have the knowledge to set up, determine the Jewish calendar, which is really the province of the high court, the Sanhedrin. So these are what they're trying to point out. And the next thing is men of renown, shame. They had a reputation throughout the whole world, which means these are not just 250 slackers. These are 250 world-class scholars, okay? Which, of course, is what? Which, of course, which I raised the question, question number three, Scott, read out the question. Question number three here.
Question number three. The 250 followers of Korach were very distinguished men. Talmud adds that they knew the most difficult areas of Jewish law, the determination of the Jewish calendar. How could these people be bamboozled to join the uprising against Moshe and Aaron?
All right, so this is shocking. And obviously that's why I started with the case of the Kabbalist rabbi from Svat, who is very highly educated, obviously, you know, very knowledgeable. Similarly, we have here, these are 250 guys. These are not losers. These are extremely bright people. What the heck is going on? Any thoughts here? Before we go to the next, we go visit our friend Rashi.
It's like the other people did. They can't believe it that they are bamboozled that this happened. These were like highly educated,
right? So
people at the top of their society.
Top of their game.
How could they do this?
Right. So that's my question to you. How do we have super highly educated people who are of the pinnacle of the Jewish community, who are extremely educated? That know more than all of us will ever know, ever. Join Korach in an insurrection against Moshe and Aaron. You know what I'm saying? It's just like there's a piece missing here. Is everybody seeing the question? Any thoughts?
They got caught up in that groupthink phenomena.
Okay, so that's a phenomena. But what drew them in? What drew them in the first place to get into the group thing? In other words, is this sort of a monarch you're suggesting, like in Hitler and the Nazis? Hitler had in 1932, 1933, these massive rallies where the unbelievable oratory, speaking ability of of Adolf Hitler was able to convince the masses of a series of lies. And that's where you're, and everybody was mesmerized by this person, sort of hypnotized them. But those are average people, okay? And it's still a question. But how about the absolute intelligentsia, the absolute brightest minds of the generation? This is very scary. All right, I'm just strengthening the case here, but nobody's really giving me an explanation. But this is a phenomenon that happens in both the Jewish world and the non-Jewish world. We have to understand it. We got to go deeper. All right, let's have Mendel read out the Rashi here.
Rashi on Bamidbar chapter 16, verse 1. Dasan and Aviram. Since the tribe of Reuven was settled in the south when they camped, thus being neighbors of Kehas and his children who were also camped in the south, they joined with Korach in his rebellion. Woe to the wicked and woe to the wicked's neighbor.
Right, so this does not explain everything. But bottom line is, this is just a good reminder. What does the idea of woe to the wicked and woe to the neighbor mean? What does that mean? Suzanne?
Well, it spreads, I feel like.
Why does it spread?
People talk.
They do talk. But it's not simply that they're just simply in close proximity.
And their actions. And
what's the phenomena of the word woe to his neighbor? That's a very significant thing. What's the dynamic between a person and their neighbor, like in America, in suburbia?
Their influence. Well, I feel like they're influenced.
They're influenced.
They can't be.
Right, because they're influenced. There's a competition, keeping up with the neighbors, right? That's the phrase we even use. So here's the basic principle. Since man is a social animal, and basically we're influenced by who we hang around with, if your friends or your neighbors are wicked people, they're going to take you down. Because the influence is not perceptible. It's sort of unconscious. The Rambam, when he talks about picking friends, you really can't protect yourself. All you can do is properly hang around wise and righteous people. You know what I'm saying? So you pick up their qualities. But if you're hanging around bad people, you're going to get pulled under. Okay, there's nothing you can do about that. It's very hard. All right, go on. Mendel?
Now, what made Korach decide to quarrel with Moshe? He envied the chieftainship of Elitzaphan, the son of Uziel, whom Moshe appointed as chieftain over the sons of Kehas by the divine word. Korach claimed, my father and his brothers were four in number, as it says the sons of Kehas were ellipses. Amram was the first, and his two sons received greatness. One a king and one Kohen Gadol. Who is entitled to receive the second position? Is it not I, who am the son of Itzar, who was the second brother of Amram? And yet Moshe appointed to the chieftainship the sons of his youngest brother. I hereby oppose him and will invalidate his word.
So Rashi, from the Midrash, says, what really ticked off Korach that launched the entire insurrection?
Felt passed over.
Right, so my father and his brother were four. So the Amram is the oldest. So his sons get the two things. One's the king, i.e. Moshe, and one is the high priest. That is going to be Aaron. So who's next? My father is Yitzchar. He's the number two son. Right? So what happened? He picked the head of the family tribe, the son of the youngest brother. So what did Korach intrinsically not have a problem with initially?
The fact that Moshe and Aaron were essentially the leaders of the nation and the high priest.
initially, why did he decide to go to war?
Initially, because he felt passed over that the youngest, that his cousin got the chieftainship of the tribe.
Yeah. So then he says, oh, then clearly it's not fair. What possibility could Karak not consider?
That he was up to snuff to be the leader.
Well, that's his assumption. So what could he not consider?
That he wasn't up to snuff to be
right. Leader. He could not even imagine.
Right. That's what I meant. Right.
Right. So that, oh, by the way, is the key. That's a key element there. What's taking the guy down?
His own ego.
Right. So he views part of the Achilles heel of being a smart person is what? Is arrogance. So he says, I'm such an amazing guy. He couldn't possibly imagine that God would not pick him. Now we know why, in fact, God did not pick him. Okay. And he got slighted. How come I'm not getting a position of, no, he's also a Levi, as Moshe tells him. He's, he's just not the head of the family. But he could not take that. And obviously, Korach, you can clear the fact that he's talking to all these great people means he's a gifted orator himself. Now, this is a shocking piece in the passage from the Talmud. All right, so let's have Suzanne read.
With regard to the verse, and Moshe heard and he fell on his face, the Gemara asks, what report did he hear that elicited that reaction? Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmani says that Rabbi Yonatan says he heard that they suspected him of adultery with a married woman, as it is stated, and they were jealous of Moshe in the camp. Rabbi Shmuel Bar Yitzhak says this teaches that each and every man warned his wife to distance himself from Moshe and not enter into seclusion with him, as it is stated, and Moshe would take the tent and pitch it outside the camp. It was due to this slander that he withdrew from the camp.
All right, so this is an amazing Talmudic passage here, where that in addition to saying that he heard the report, the plain text is that he heard what Korach had to say, that basically he's challenging Moshe's, and by definition, God's selection of Aaron to be the high priest, right? But apparently there's an additional layer that was sort of a subtext, according to the Midrash, he kind of heard. What was really being accused of?
Adultery.
So why would they say that Moshe has adultery? And this gets into a very important psychological point here. Why could you possibly accuse Moshe of adultery? That's crazy. If you know psychology, not crazy at all. Dan Lastman, are you there?
Yes, hi. How are you doing?
Good. So I'm asking you the question. How is it possible that the Jewish people, at least midrashically, can possibly accuse Moshe, the master of all prophets, with having an affair with a married woman? And therefore, to the degree, says the Talmud, that every woman, every husband said to every woman, be careful not to be alone with Moshe, our teacher. How's that possible? It's not crazy talk. But if you know a little bit about psychology, it's not crazy at all.
Yeah, I think they're jealous of him, and they're using the slander to try and ruin his reputation and basically rebel against him and overthrow his rule, so to speak.
So, but the question is, but why do they? In other words, it could be that they're jealous of his authority, as clearly we learned that Korach was. Okay, but why did they pick the adultery thing? Why that one in particular?
Well, it makes it kind of like a personal insult to everybody that they feel you know, personally threatened by him if he's going around and being inappropriate with people, you know, kind of behind everybody's back. It's very threatening to people's you know, sense of security.
Right. So basically, they're putting this is basically a Me Too movement situation. Basically, these people are accusing openly or either overtly or covertly that basically Moshe is a sexual predator. Now, how is this possible? Let me explain. One of the basic elements of psychology is that basically is a phenomena of projection. As we go down to the Gemara there above Matzia, Rav Natan said, a defect that is in you, do not mention it in another. The natural tendency, a person wants or a person complains about somebody else, frequently they're exposing and they're talking about their own weakness, their own limitation, their own. And basically, psychologically, if they're accusing him of adultery, what basically that means? Why would they come to such far-fetched and ridiculous conclusion?
Because they have an insecurity about that issue in themselves.
Go a little further. Why? You need to take one step further.
You think they were all committing adultery?
No. In other words, they're imagining, if I was the king, if I was the boss, if I was the ruler of the Jews, what would I use my power for?
To take advantage of people and sleep with them.
We have a character in Tanakh. Who's the name of the character in Tanakh that does it openly? Achashverosh.
Achashverosh. Okay.
Right. They imagine Moshe. If I was Moshe, what would I do? I basically take advantage of people.
Well, I mean, not to equate Achashverosh to David, but am I incorrect in my memory when I say David did the similar thing?
Yes. Okay. Yes, he used his power to have a wrong relationship, which according to the plain text is even an adulterous relationship with Bathsheba.
I mean, he does tshuva, but...
He does tshuva. Okay, now, that gets to a very... We're going to put it all together. Let's read this another passage from the Gemara. Read this one. This is a very important phrase. Remember, read it out.
Brachos?
Brachos 29a.
Brachos 29a. Do not be sure of yourself until the day you die. As Yochanan the high priest served in the high priesthood for 80 years and ultimately became a Sadducee. Even one who is outstanding in his righteousness can become a heretic.
Okay. So the Talmud says, this is, and maybe that's really quoting the Mishnah, Al-Tanah be'atzmacha ad yomoso. Do not be confident or sure about yourself until the day you die. Because the bottom line is to be a person, is to be vulnerable, is to be fragile. Let me share something. So we started off the class with a question. How is it possible that such a renowned and knowledgeable rabbi could have used his position to sleep with women, which unfortunately happened in Israel, and the guy was given 7.5 years of prison just about a couple months ago? How is this possible?
Well, he was either overconfident in his learning or underestimated his animal desires or some such thing.
He
like drank the Kool-Aid. He really believed it, that he could do what he was doing.
Well, maybe he may have, of course, is going to rationalize himself, but in other words, there are certain, in other words, here's the interesting thing. There are challenges and temptations when you become a leader and when you are given so much power that actually has a corroding and corrupting effect.
Is that like the saying, like, power corrupts absolute, power corrupts absolutely?
100%. It's aligned with that idea. In other words, that Korach made a projection, says, I'm awesome. He could not imagine, or it's when Moshe tells him that Hashem picked his younger cousin, what should he have done?
Well, one thing he could have done was reflected on, you know, what element of his personality is lacking that he did not or he could not attain that position.
Yes, that could have been a tremendous wake-up call. If he really, in other words, if all things being equal, he should have had the position, but yet God picked his younger cousin instead of him, that should have been an opportunity, a wake-up call, like sort of an intervention, that he's got some issue that he should address, and that giving the position of power would not be healthy for him, right? But no, he has a given that he is awesome. He's the best thing since sliced bread. He is perfected. And he's now blind. He's blind to the fact that he has an egotistical drive, that he must be a leader. So then he goes on, says basically, and he has a whole attack against Moshe and impugning that basically that Moshe does not know what he's doing. He picked his brother for what reason? Nepotistic reasons. He picked his brother because he's his brother. Okay? Now, in order to build a good attack, he builds a coalition of the disgruntled. He's got the 250 men. He's got the people of Reuven. He's got different people. The Medrash says that everybody was disgruntled in Moshe because they were extremely suspicious of him. Why? Projection. Because they say anybody who's got that unqualified power has to do it for what? For some nefarious reason. Basically, they're saying, if I was in that position, that's what I would do. So he must be doing it. Now, they didn't appreciate Moshe. Now, let's put this all together here. In other words, now, what's the counterpoint to that? What does it mean, don't be sure of yourself until the day you die? What does that tell us? What does that teach us? Let me share with you one idea that I think is very common among when working in the Baal Tshuva community. Many people in the Baal Tshuva community are becoming more committed to their Judaism, often feel that I see these Jews who are FFB, from birth, and they know what to do. They're in synagogue, they know when to stand up, they know when to sit down. Like a classic situation. A person who's becoming newly acquainted with Judaism goes in Friday night. He goes into the kitchen to wash his hands. He sees the women holding their rings in their mouth to wash their hands. He thought that as a precursor to washing your hands, you need to put a ring in your mouth. Because the women didn't have any, you know, in their dress, they didn't have any pockets. So he said, I guess before you wash, you got to put a ring in your mouth. He didn't know. So he's looking around for a ring. I need a ring before I wash my hands, okay? So many people believe that if I know all the rituals, I know when to stand up, when to sit down, I can read Hebrew like a pro, I can wash my hands, I can say the motzi, I can make kiddush, I can do birkas hamazon with a tune, I know all the rites, salutations for every one of the holidays, for Shabbos and Yom Tov and Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and Sukkot, I know what to do. You would think I'd be home free. The reality is, no. The rituals are important, but the inner part of Judaism, the inner struggle is the developing your inner world. We have examples in the story here, both the modern story and the story of Korach, that Korach was a well-educated person. Certainly he's able to influence 250 basically members of the Sanhedrin or that level of person, people who are highly educated, but yet still blind to the basic, to the intoxicating desire of power. You know what I'm saying? In other words, the fact that you know how to wash your hands is not going to help you being, whether you are going to be blind or not blind to your power needs. And Pirkei Avos says, don't be sure of yourself until the day you die, which means the person feels like, oh, I learned, I've accomplished this area, I got this down. I'm not going to be subject to any kind of what? Any kind of influence. No. The nature of mankind, men and women in general, we are very fragile creatures. And we can be very, very much influenced. And you can't have any sense of confidence, you know, overconfidence in yourself. That, oh, no problem. Okay? And the fact is that part of the tragedy of that, of the particular rabbi of, from Svat, that, in other words, we're not talking about a rabbi, he was the head of a yeshiva head. Very few people have the skill set to be a head of a yeshiva. You have to be pretty well educated. Not to mention he knew all the Kabbalistic stuff, which, you know, I don't, you know, that's another thing. So he had this community, and basically he was given temptations that he couldn't admit that he had, and was not, and overwhelmed with. You know, or just the classic situation, you know, the classic joke, like, I was watching Conan O'Brien. You guys on? So Conan had what's that guy? Who's a comedian? He has all the time. Guys from Boston. I'm blanking on his name.
You're talking about like the co-anchor kind of.
No, not the co-anchor. No, he has a comedian comes in all the time.
Bill Burr.
So Bill Burr had the following point. He says, everybody when Tiger Woods had these affairs with all the women. People are saying, like, that guy, if I was him, I would have just said no. He says, that's ridiculous. You're a guy. You're at Walmart. You're stacking the lawn furniture. There's not going to be these Scandinavian models coming up to you in aisle 7 saying, hey, you want to come sleep with me? No. Nobody coming up to you like that. They're walking past you. They're not even in your store. Okay? So, you know, you're not even in the league to even possibly consider this challenge. But if you were Tiger Woods, basically a near, you know, multimillionaire, where women of the most beautiful, you know, most beautiful women are throwing themselves at you, that's a challenge which nearly all people would fail.
I don't understand what this guy was. It seems to me, this, and I, correct me if I'm wrong, it seems to me this guy is significantly more twisted.
No, he is more twisted. No, I'm just bringing up the Bill Burr point is a point which is that people are trying to project in their life what it's like to be like a person who is far more famous, far more successful, far more powerful. When you're a powerful person, you are subject to far more temptations. In other words, you see what the Gemara is saying. Oh, Moshe's having an affair with adult women. And all the guys start to say, Gary, stay away from Moshe. Because they're imagining, they're fantasizing. If I was the king of the Jews like Moshe, you know what I'd be doing? I'd basically be an Achashverosh. I'd be sleeping with all the women. That's basically what it's all about. That's why Moshe fell on his face, according to the Midrash. To teach you that, not only was he totally overwhelmed with the challenge of authority by Korach and his group, but the fact is that that basically everybody had a projected ill about him, and the only way that he could educate the people that he's not doing it out of his own interest, but rather it's God's selection. He needs God's help to do all these miracles because he can't argue. The point is saying, no, I'm not doing it for my own. You can't argue that, no, I'm not doing it for nepotistic reasons. You know what I'm saying? I'm doing it because Hashem told me to do that. Because the entire trust of Moshe Rabbeinu had been completely damaged. Korach and his group of the coalition of the disgruntled have been successful in indicting Moshe as being a trustworthy person, a trustworthy leader. And everything's coming out. So I'm not validating this rabbi in Svat for doing what he's doing, but I want you to understand that part of his, in other words, he's, in fact, just to give you a corollary to this, so I belong to a rabbinic organization called the Rabbinical Council of America, okay? And they and it was the congregational rabbis. It's a group of congregational rabbis, and you know, rabbis who are Jewish educators. So they have a best practices about doing pastoral work. So if you're a rabbi, and imagine that vulnerable women are coming to you because they're in the middle of a divorce, or they're trying, or they're dealing with a conversion. That's not, in other words, a woman who's in a vulnerable situation, you are helping them, that could be, that could not end well. Okay? You know what I'm saying? So they have a whole protocol how to handle that situation. Do it in concert with, if you have a Rebbetzin, do it in concert with her. In other words, you do it ideally women should deal with women, if that's the ideal, or in concert with that, or that basically if you're having a pastoral session, the door is essentially ajar, and there are people in the other room, you know, basically that there are checks and balances, because as we just read in the Talmud over there, that don't be sure of yourself until the day you die. You think, I would never do that. I guarantee you, this guy, before he made his own, whatever crazy rationalization he made in his own mind, he would never, if I spoke to him 20 years ago, are you going to be a guy who's going to use your position and sleep with 10 women who are married, and not only women, but the wives of your own students. Even more betrayal.
No, I mean,
so I'm not, my point being is that great men fail. The Torah is telling us great men fail, A, when they get blinded by their egotistical needs, because by part of being a great man is that you're more, you are clearly superior in certain ways to other people, so you start to ascribe greatness to yourself. A. B, you're, since you're in a position of power, you have greater access to things that other people do not have. You know what I'm saying? So by it could be a very challenging situation. In other words, the challenge of an everyday person is not the challenge of a leader like this. Of all these people. You know what I'm saying? I'm not explaining why they, in other words, Rashi talks about how the thing was triggered, but fundamentally, when a person has this egotistical sense of themselves, and they have strong, you know, and they start feeling like they're entitled, and they're like the king, you know, bad things are going to start to happen. Ahasuerus, by the way, had no, just to go to the contrast with the Ahasuerus story, Ahasuerus had no compunction by telling his staff, get me all the beautiful women of the 127 provinces of my kingdom. And that all these women are going to be brought to Shushan and then be permanently married to him, either as one would be the wife and the other thousands would be his concubines. He had no problem with that.
It was probably like a Miss USA contest, like Trump was running.
Well, no, but as the Megillah says clearly, that every night he slept with a different one.
All right, not exactly alike, but I'm saying, I mean, in order worse. To even
worse,
yeah,
worse. Well, that really is a take home here. In other words, that. And that's exactly what the Me Too, all the scenarios we had in the last year of all these great men, or I don't want to use the word great men, all these famous and powerful men, okay? The narrative is always the same. They had power over their employees. The employees are trying to move up the ladder, whether you're an actress trying to, or a model trying to get a, you know, a career, you know, open a career enhancing role in a Weinstein production, or you're working for Charlie Rose, allegedly you're working for all these different people, and you're forced to do things because you know that if you're going to say anything, you're going to get fired and knocked out of the entire industry. So this is the, in other words, the nature of a powerful person is to have extremely powerful temptations, and only a very perfected person can really endure it. In other words, it's literally just the opposite. That's the Chiddush. If you are a powerful person, and people are fawning over you and telling how marvelous you are, and you are blessed with tremendous financial and success, you're starting to believe your own narrative that you're awesome, just like Korach, you're awesome. And you feel very entitled to sleep with this intern and take advantage of this actress, etc. And you know that you have the power and the clout and the money to either pay people off or shut them down in other ways. And that's really the Me Too movement, as they know, of all bosses taking advantage of their younger women employees. And the truth is, what does the Torah teach us? We have the laws of Yichud. You're not allowed to be alone. Oh, I would never do anything. No, you have to assume that you would always do something. Okay? And the way, and you don't put yourself in a position, you avoid being in positions where the situation is going to get out of control. So you're not alone with men are not alone with women. Women are alone with men. And you can't, and you don't trust yourself. The corollary of this is another statement from the Talmud. I didn't put it down. Ein apotropos l'arayos, which means there is no person cannot be their own guardian to sexual immorality. In other words, you can't be the guardian to yourself. In other words, you can't be watching the chicken coop yourself. The fox, in other words, I think the phrase is, the fox can't be watching the chicken coop. We are the fox. Man is vulnerable. And you have to be extremely careful. And you have to create certain checks and balances. One is halacha, is the prohibitions of yichud, of seclusion. One is the idea of, you know, just of course, one of the themes we talked about is humility, understanding ask yourself the following question: where do I stand in the spectrum of the entire universe? How big am I in the perspective of the entire universe? There's Hashem, there's the universe, and there's me. I mean, I'm not that big, and I'm not that important, I'm not that significant. And to live with that kind of mindedness. And all the mitzvahs that we talked about over the year, being sensitive to the other person, to the poor, to the orphan, to the widow, to the convert, it's all trying to make the person recognize that I'm no different than the next person. We both have basic needs, not to be sensitive to that. It's a gestalt of a humility. And going back to the Baal Tshuva, yes, in a certain sense, there is an advantage to knowing all the quote-unquote ritual and what to do practically of living an Orthodox life, but that is really, it's a challenge, but it's a small challenge compared to the challenges of arrogance versus humility, power and desire. These are, as we see, the Torah spends a lot of time talking about, these are more our pressing. And to be, when nobody's looking, to be conscientious, to help those who are disadvantaged. The major theme in the entire Tanakh. Those are the real, in other words, the truth is, if you start, you know, hanging out with people who keep Shabbos like 3-4 times, it becomes like there's a groove to it. It has a natural rhythm and it becomes not like, oh, there's so many rules. No, it becomes a doable situation because you can get into a groove. These areas are challenging. You know what I'm saying? And Korach, who also was a great man, and you know, obviously, in other words, only a gifted orator could convince, can turn 250 other great men to his side. You know what I'm saying? So they're talking about, you know, very smart people, but there's the Achilles heel of the smart great man is his own ego, because he's so accomplished and because he's so powerful, he's uniquely vulnerable to all kinds of bad stuff, which the regular man does not have to encounter. You know what I'm saying? In other words, a regular bus driver for the MTA in New York City, who's driving the bus on 86th Street back and forth 8 hours a day, he's not struggling with how to handle interns. Okay? That's not his challenge because he's got no authority. He drives the bus. Oh, you're a CEO of a Fortune 500 company, like the guy Wynn from the company, what's the name of the company? The one that that had all the casinos. He had to resign. Another meeting. You know, he's taking advantage of women again. So, because
Donald Trump
in casinos. Donald Trump himself. Yeah, he's been, obviously accused of all kinds of stuff. Exactly. That's it. That brings the point home extremely clear. So that really is a understanding of the fundamental message of this thing, is that how could these great men just fail like this? And we have a little bit of understanding here that fundamentally is that when you are in a power position, the desires become far more intoxicating. And in a certain sense, you become weaker. And you're more subject to these problems. And we brought up some of the issues about that. All right, guys. Any questions? All right.
Yashar Koach, thank you.
Have a great night, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi. Thank you, Rabbi Lai.
Have a night.